Right now in studio, we're going to have a conversation about monarch butterflies. And my guest is Ron Hellstern. He's chairman of the Cache Valley Wildlife Association. And Ron, I have to tell you, this kind of excites me because I've been putting caterpillars in my house since as long as I can remember. And I'm thankful to a first grade teacher who got this started with me. And so wherever I've seen milkweeds, I've always been on the lookout for monarch caterpillars to bring into the house and help them along their journey. So that's our conversation today. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Ron, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here. Appreciate the offer.
So where did your interest come for monarch butterflies?
Same thing. I'm from Illinois originally, and I used to find a lot of interesting creatures in our acreage where we lived. Fireflies, lightning bugs, and I've only seen those once out here. But monarchs used to be all over the place, so when I came out here, I had that natural affinity for them. And I tried to pass it on to my students when I was teaching at South Cache. So the idea was to understand a little bit more about these amazing and beautiful insects and where they go in the winter for migration.
So what amazes you the most about the monarch butterfly?
I think the idea that, and I realize that there are some people out there that don't care too much whether butterflies are around or not, but I think the underestimation we have of pollinating insects and the importance they bring to us for our food crops and things is incredible. We need to have these creatures, birds that pollinate, as well as butterflies and bees. But the interest came in trying to see if we could get them to understand a little bit more about how they their life cycle and how they migrate. And when we compare them to birds, because everybody's pretty familiar with how ducks and geese and swans and things migrate, and robins and so forth. And the young birds are following their parents down to the southern migration overwintering sites. With monarchs, it's completely different, and it's amazing. It's not completely understood yet because the monarchs, the adult monarchs that we see up here live anywhere from 2 to maybe 6 weeks. But the migrating adults in late August, September that are heading back south, They don't mate, and they'll overwinter in sites on the eastern side of the Rockies down in Mexico and on the western states that go to Southern California. And they can live for 4, 5, 6 months until mating time comes. But the idea that's really unique about it is it's the fourth generation that actually migrates down there. And baby birds are following mom and dad south. But these monarchs are four generations away from the originals that started in Mexico or Southern California, and have since been replaced by parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents, but still return back to those overwintering sites. It's amazing.
Do we know how to get back here?
Not completely. I think a lot of it has to do with chemoreceptors that they have, as well as the way they can determine polarized light and things like that. But I wouldn't be the first person to jump up and say, yeah, I know how they do that, because I'm not certain yet. Okay. And I also don't know how do they get across the Great Basin Desert and things like that to get to California.
There must be some places that they go to in the middle of the desert in order to find the water and the energy to keep going that far.
Absolutely. They have to have the energy as well as water substances to keep them going. And that's one of the things I think we got involved with the Monarch program, which is in Southern California, to try and find out about the Intermountain Monarchs, Idaho, Utah, and so forth. Where do they go? What are the routes? And how can we protect or provide way stations for them to make sure they can make this journey? And we're seeing that the biggest problem has been habitat loss for them, because monarchs are extremely particular. They have one single host plant, and without that, the species will go extinct. And you and I were talking earlier about the article in the Audubon magazine where we know that at one point the most populated species on the planet was the passenger pigeon. Perhaps billions, some people think, and they're all gone. And now we're down to the millions of monarchs, and they're depleting rapidly. And at least we got a pretty good idea why that's the case. Loss of milkweed, which is a sole plant that keeps them, the eggs and the larvae and so forth alive. They have to have that as a host plant. And then the overwintering forests in specific microclimates in Mexico and Southern California, as those are being logged, sometimes illegally, that eliminates places for them to go.
I know. I've noticed in the last 10 years the population's just in my own backyard taking a nosedive. 2 years ago, I didn't see a one.
Yeah.
Last year, I saw one. So for me, I'm thinking, all right, so what I need to do is plant some milkweed. Now, the word weed might throw some people off. Is it? It's not on the noxious weed list, is it?
Okay. It is not. It's not treated by the state
or
the county.
So let's call it a milk plant.
It's native. I like milk plant or butterfly plant.
There we go.
That's
even better.
So the idea that it is the single host plant. Monarchs have not been seen. There was a rumor one time they went on dogbame. That's never been verified. So it's milkweed or nothing, and they'll go extinct. And like you say, most people look at it, it's a weed. It's not a noxious weed. We just need to take a look. As acreage disappears, when I started this project back in 1998 at South Cache, and our students would go, we'd get 125 and so forth and tag and release them and let them go. And this last year we had three that were called into me that we would mark. And I'd ask schools, too, if they have any, and the larva pupates and comes out of the chrysalis as a butterfly, wait 3 days, call me, we'll come mark it. And then the schools can have it and let it go at their own leisure. But the numbers have just been dropping precipitously.
To me, there's just nothing more spectacular than to be able to watch this life cycle in a jar in your own home. And then I guess that's why I started it when I was 5 and 6 years old, because you get to see them grow from these tiny little caterpillars to, within a matter of days, they're humongously bigger, and then to go through the whole pupation process. And once in all of my years, I was able to catch a chrysalis popping open with that butterfly. Hmm. You know, I just was just waiting and waiting and waiting, and every time I went past the table, I'd watch and watch. And I just happened to see that little slit open up, and I'm like, oh, cool.
Here we go.
It is just the most amazing thing to watch. Yeah. So you were saying before the program, if a human baby were to eat as much as a caterpillar, how large would it get?
If you take a 6-pound human baby, and if it ate at the same rate that a monarch larva does, then within 2 weeks it would weigh 16,000 pounds. They'll put on 2,700 times their own weight from the time they get started. So it's a very small larva that comes out of that egg. It eats the eggshell first, and it starts eating the little hairs on the bottom of the milkweed leaf, and then eats and eats and eats 24 hours a day so it can put on the fat and grow into the stages it needs to get up into the chrysalis and eventually become a metamorphosize into the adult.
So to help with this project, if you're looking for a milkweed, where would you find milkweed?
And there may be a question, too, of what species. And just the common milkweed, if you're worried about when you look at milkweed garden supplies and things like that, look at the stuff that's just growing around the air here in Cache Valley. You usually find it on roadsides and ditch banks are the easiest place to locate those. I know that I can't imagine that farmers and agriculture industries are going to want to have milkweed all over their fields. That's not a cash crop for them, so that's understood. But that's why we need to take a look at supplanting those in our own gardens and yard areas and so forth, because they won't take over a yard. You can pretty much control them. But yeah,
they're okay to have in the ditch bank. There's no reason to get rid of them. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, they're not doing any harm there, and they do produce. They're a prolific seed producer. There's no question. They've got the little silky parachute things that'll help them get off and get going. But and blow around the area. But again, if they land in places that's not conducive to have that seed germinate, then it's not going to take over a place either.
And milkweeds are not invasive. If you plant them in your own home, you're not going to find them like quack grass or something getting into the neighbor's yards or
the soil's,
into your flower bed.
Soil's got to be ready and bare in some areas where it's got to be taken over. But again, I can think of when we were in South Cache, we'd take the classes out and hike down towards the Hiram Reservoir and pass open fields that were loaded with milkweed. All that's gone now because it's been replaced by housing. I've got nothing against development. I'm just saying that's one of those things you've got to take a look at, that it's a fact.
So are you looking for the caterpillars on the undersides of the leaves?
Exactly. You find a milkweed patch, and usually they're in some of the uppermost leaves, but they're always on the underside. The females know enough to give that chrysalis little protection, and they're not cocoons, they're not spinning, it's a chrysalis that's formed from the outer layers of the larva's skin. And so you can tell when they're getting ready to do that. They'll climb up to the top of this leaf itself of the plant, stay on the underside of it, and have a little organ by its mouth called a spinneret, and they spill kind of like a silky substance, and then turn around, and in their backside, they've got a little hook called a cremaster, and they hook onto that, and then they get into kind of a little J shape. When you see that letter J, then they're ready to start forming into the chrysalis shape. And then within about 2 weeks, 1 to 2 weeks in that time period, it'll metamorphosize into the adult butterfly.
Are there that many predators with monarch butterflies?
The biggest thing to do, I think, is if you're interested in helping this out, this project, so we can tag these butterflies, is to catch the caterpillars when they're quite small. Once they get to full size, about 2 inches, there's a fly called the tachinid fly. The females will come around and with an ovipositor stick in the back of that caterpillar and inject an egg. That egg will then eat the caterpillar inside out and kill it, but you get a fly, and the fly looks just like a regular house fly. So there's the predators on caterpillars. Normally not, because the milkweed plant itself has got a toxin in it, and so most vertebrates don't mess around with the caterpillars at all. There are a couple of bird species, black-backed orioles and grosbeaks, that will eat adults, but most of the times birds, jays and things, when they eat that, they'll actually vomit and get quite sick, and they've learned, I'm not eating that again, and they pass that information on to their offspring. And so most of the time those bright colors in nature indicate, you probably don't want to mess with me, I'm not going to taste good.
Okay. And if people want to contact you and let you know that they've got some caterpillars and want to have them tagged?
I always write a letter to the editor in the Herald Journal late August into September, asking for schools, once you get back in, go ahead and have them in your classrooms, but give me a call. My phone number is 435-512-6938. You can also look, we're just developing this brand new, it's the only affiliate with the National Wildlife Federation in the state of Utah through the Cache Valley Wildlife Association. And we're getting asked to have booths set up all over the place now, so we'll be at the Gardener's Market and the Bear River Celebration and Nibley Heritage Days and the Mountain Music Festival in Mendon and so forth. But if nothing else, Google us at Cache Valley Wildlife Association and it'll pull up. Our website should be going within a day or two. We're just putting it together right now.
We've got about 9 more minutes if you'd like to join our conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can go online to upr.org and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So with the monarch butterfly, you see all different sizes. Are the females typically smaller in size or larger? Are they? I sometimes see a little bit difference in the patterns. What are the differences?
Females can be a little bit larger, but it's pretty tough to tell from a distance. From 6 feet or so, it's rough. But if you get up close, they've got multifaceted eyes, and so you've got to be careful as you approach. But it's difficult to tell unless you have a chance to get a male and a female together. But I've got a sample here. The male on the bottom hind wings has got a little black dot on the bottom wing, and where the veins are a little bit thicker. Again, probably chemoreceptors there. But otherwise, they look almost identical.
Yeah, I can't really see much difference between the two at all.
Yeah, let me see here. See the male, the black dot right here,
yep.
A bit lower on the wing. That's it. So again, and the interesting thing, I guess, between butterflies and moths, is that butterflies will open and close wings and moths won't. So if you can get up close enough, catching an adult butterfly is going to be a little bit tricky and you might damage it anyway. So the best thing is to get the larva. And then I guess we should talk a little bit about how we were trying to track these things.
Yeah, one of the concerns is having the types of plants that will attract all different kinds of pollinators, not just butterflies, but birds and bees as well. And I've seen a trend in some of the sunflower seed varieties that you can get that are pollenless. And like, okay, well, that's not going to do a whole lot of good. So what do you suggest?
Yeah, native plant species, obviously, are the way to go, because any of the pollinators and local birds and things, that's what they're looking for. They're used to it, and they're used to the climate and so forth. I'm always a little bit depressed when I go into some of the bigger box stores and they're selling anything that says grows best, you know, in zone 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
They will not survive here. Save your money, folks. Look for the things that are at the 3, 4, 5 zone range, and those will grow and prosper here. But from the studies that I've seen, the number one plant that butterflies really like to have is Mexican sunflower called Tithonia. but also a butterfly weed, Buddleia, which is butterfly bush, but any of the great nectar producers and pollen producers, purple coneflower, penstemons and things like that that would normally grow here anyway, daisies and things that, that would be here. That's what they're looking for, and they'll use it. But if you're trying to attract them to your yard, they'll come through and they'll eat. It's kind of like a fast food restaurant. They'll come by and eat something. But if you want them to linger and to do an overproduction or a reproduction in that series, then they have to have milkweed too. So a great backyard garden would have water and nectar sources and the host plant milkweed and some shelter too.
So how easily can you grow a milkweed from seed?
They're not difficult as far as it goes, but again, germination rates are never 100% on any particular plant. So when you look for the milkweeds, my students used to say that the seed pods kind of look like dill pickles to them. And when those things start to open up, you'll see, you know, hundreds of seeds in each one of those, and they have to be massively produced because they don't all germinate. So, but they can be grown in pots or in garden spots too.
And if you see the seed pods, can you? What's the best way to do? Just take a handful of them and gently cover them a little bit with the seed. As we've learned from Dan Drost, extension vegetable specialist, he said you never plant a seed more than three times the depth of its thickness. So with these seeds, they're not that thick. So I would think you don't put very much soil on the top.
Exactly. I think just get it in and barely cover it. Remember that they're going to be airborne because they've got these little silken parachute things and taken around. So probably not trodden into the soil very deep. So when we're going to plant them, I can just barely cover them with soil, make sure that they're going to be good and moist, and sit back, cross your fingers, wait for the weather and nature to do the rest.
And the winter just takes care of it? And
yep.
Then I imagine they probably have to have some cold hours to them, which is why you don't plant them in the spring.
Right. So they have to be scarified, and there's two ways you can do that. One is to take the seeds out and put them in a jar. You can put sand in there or something like that and shake the jar around and scratch the surface to get them going, or a winter substance, so they get in freezing, keep them in your refrigerator, things like that, so they've got that cold temperature to get them ready to go in the spring.
Hmm. Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. We have just a couple minutes left with Ron Hellstern. He is the chairman of the Cache Valley Wildlife Association, and we're talking about monarch butterflies. And if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495, or you can go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So for this summer, are there any ideas how the populations are going to be? What did the California overwintering areas look like?
Yeah, the populations are down considerably, and there's a couple reasons for that. I know that you see pictures in magazines once in a while. There are millions or certainly hundreds of thousands of butterflies covering trees. In Mexico right now, the Oyamel trees, they need a specific microclimate. So when they leave the U.S. and they're heading down to Mexico, they're up in these forests where the temperature is cool enough so their metabolism slows down so they don't use up all their food deposits and they don't have to worry about feeding during that time. The illegal logging going down there has been incredible, and I think right now, last I've heard, that they've got about 2% of the original forest that they used to have these butterflies come in. Only 2% remains. And you know what California's like if you've been there recently, the coastal forests, just because of housing. And I'm not saying that butterflies populations are more important than human development and human housing. I'm not saying that at all. But if one thing happens, then the result happens too. You pick up one end of the stick, the other end of the stick comes up with it. So I would just hate to see this, where the only place that our grandkids are going to be able to see monarchs may be in a museum or something like the passenger pigeon. So again, trying to track these things, where we mark them. We used to put small tags in the butterfly wings and found out that when they would roost by the thousands in these trees, the people in the overwintering sites couldn't tell where the tags were from. Mm. And so they've now come up with 15 different marking patterns with a felt tip pen and four different colors. So there's 60 different color patterns. So now with a pair of binoculars, these scientists can take a look up in these trees and see what the color and the marking is, and they know exactly what region those butterflies came from. And then we know a little bit about retracing the route, and can we have way stations with, again, milkweed and nectar plants along the way to maintain this population.
Is there anything to indicate that our butterflies head further south and then cut across, or do they go directly straight from, at least here in Cache Valley, across the mountain?
Of the hundreds we've tagged since 1998, we've had a report of one being seen in Southern California. How it got there is still a mystery. So that's why we're trying to get more and more people to get involved with this. And
especially because we have fewer and fewer monarchs.
Exactly. So I think I've talked with folks in the Audubon Society. I'm a member of their board of trustees, too. I think we're going to try to marshal the forces and really go out and try and get as many larvae as we can in August, September, raise them as adults, mark them, and get them out of here as soon as possible. When the temperature hits 40 degrees, the butterflies are doomed. They don't even fly after it hits 55, so we need to get them out of here as soon as possible.
Okay, and to contact you, your phone number is 435-512-6938.
Correct.
And that's Ron Hellstern. He's chairman of the Cache Valley Wildlife Association. So be on the lookout for those orange, beautiful monarch butterflies this August and September.
They can also email me if they want. Okay. I love Southern Utah's Zion National Park. If you just think of redrockron, R-O-N, at gmail.com, I'd be glad to visit with you on email.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Thank you for joining us on today's program. We'll have Petals and Pros back next week.